In her literary essay, Susan Sontag seemed to break all the rules, and along the way she dazzled her readers through the richness of her style and her almost effortless way of juggling what sometimes sound like contradictory ideas. Philip Lopate, who has also dazzled his readers through his personal essays, has analyzed Sontag's work in a book-length appreciation called Notes on Sontag. It's published by Princeton University Press as part of their Writers on Writers series. And it brings my brother back to the show. Hi, Philip.
Hi, great to see you again.
Did you know... We had dinner last night.
Yes. Yeah.
Did you know Susan Sontag?
I knew her slightly, yes. I had gone to Columbia College, and she taught there. And over the years, because we were both film buffs and both on the New York Film Festival selection committee, I would run into her.
And she was considered a superstar on campus, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah. She was at that time called the Natalie Wood of the intelligentsia. And she was very striking looking.
Yes. And she was teaching what, comparative religion?
Yes, she was teaching comparative religions, which was interesting. Yeah.
Well, how does that manifest itself in the work?
Well, I do think that she tried to find a spiritual dimension in aesthetics. So she herself was not really interested in pushing any organized religion, but she was very interested in work that had a kind of contemplative quality where you could reach higher aesthetic or spiritual states.
Isn't this something of a departure for you? Would you have even considered attempting such a deep analysis of a writer's work if Princeton University Press hadn't asked you to write something for them?
They did ask me. In a way, it was a departure, and in a way, not, because I'm always interested in analyzing my own contradictory thoughts and ambivalences, and this was a perfect opportunity. And I also like the idea of writing a book-length essay. In a way...
Which you've never done before.
Well, Waterfront, I think, was a kind of book-length essay about New York City. In this case, I could just keep thinking and ruminating and writing the most honestly that I could.
But did you choose Sontag as your subject?
I did. Because
considering your obvious ambivalence about her, why choose somebody like her?
Exactly, because I did have mixed feelings. It meant that I could try to work them out on the page. If I chose somebody who I was purely in love with, I would run out of things to say and just keep saying, well, read them, what can I say? But with Sontag, I loved some of her work. And others I disagreed with or mistrusted. Some of the work that I loved I also disagreed with. So it was a question of going through it piece by piece and saying, do I really agree with this? Do I think this is good? So in a way it was a much more dynamic relationship to a subject than I could have done if I just picked somebody who I admired.
Well, what makes her writing so compelling? Was it the content of the essays, or the style, the way she argued a case?
She had a lot of conviction, you know. She backed it strong, and she would throw herself into a position. A lot of the work that I like the best, her 20, 25-page essays, she would take a position, she would zero in on it, and she would nail it. You know, and she had a lot of courage also. She wasn't afraid of coming on strong. And she created this character who, in a way, is the most vivid character she ever created, much more so than the ones in her novels, which was the character of Susan Sontag.
So that was an invention. Pretty much everybody who writes
has to invent a persona.
You're inventing a persona.
Yes. In her case, you know, she was this kid from Arizona and California who grew up in the lap of American popular culture and felt very alienated from it and came east and then went to Europe. And so in many ways she was trying to be a European intellectual from an unlikely background.
But you write personal essays.
Yes.
And she said, my books are not a means of discovering who I am. I've never fancied the ideology of writing as therapy or self-expression.
Yes. Well, I don't fancy it as therapy or self-expression either, but of course I don't have any problem writing personally and writing autobiographically. And I think that one of the paradoxes with Sontag was that whenever she did write a personal essay, she did a beautiful job of it. She has a wonderful essay on Paul Goodman and her relationship with him. She has a beautiful essay on travel. The opening pages in America, some of the pages in her novels, The Volcano Love, are also quite personal and autobiographical. I think she had ambivalent feelings about it herself. She thought that it was tacky to write about yourself, to draw attention to yourself, and she preferred the impersonal in art.
Well, she had cancer, and although she wrote an entire book on illness and disease, she never once shared that personal aspect of the story.
She didn't, I know. Although her next book, AIDS as Metaphor on Illness, she did come out and say that she had had cancer. So one of the reasons that I thought it was intriguing for me to write about her is that I don't have this ambivalence about the personal, and I feel that Sontag, in many ways, was always expressing her character, was always writing quite personally, in spite of the fact that she may not have used the word I. And so she's a kind of model of someone who mistrusted the personal but was also drawn to it. The same one with psychology. She put down psychology. She said, you know, that psychology was so yesterday, you know. But whenever she wrote psychologically, like in her profiles on Walter Benjamin or Canetti or Pavese, she showed that she had quite an astute take on psychology.
And she had been married to Philip Reif, who wrote a biography of Freud.
Yeah, well, that may have had something to do with her dislike of Freud and psychology, no question. She was rebelling against that marriage to some degree.
Philip Lopate is my guest. His book, Notes on Sontag, is published by Princeton University Press. He also has contributed to another book called Brothers, 26 Stories of Love and Rivalry, which is edited by Andrew Blauner and published by Jossie Bass. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When you're writing about personal things, when you are, do you ever worry about crossing a line?
I always worry about crossing a line, but I have to admit that when I'm writing, I don't worry about it so much. That is, I give myself the freedom not to censor myself, but later on I worry like crazy. And when I wrote this essay about you, I was aware that it was a kind of minefield, and I didn't want to, since we have a good relationship and love each other, I didn't want to offend you. On the other hand, I didn't want to write a completely bland essay that was...
I would have preferred a hagiography.
Yeah, but I, again, where do you find the tension if you're just praising someone? And I also am willing to blow the whistle on myself, which I do somewhat in this essay as well. So for me, the tightrope act was that I wanted to write something that had enough honesty and enough vulnerability in it that one could get a sense of the dynamic of our relationship as brothers, but not tell everything.
Well, I was also approached to write something for that book, and yes, I couldn't figure out how to do it without revealing something that would have made either you or me uncomfortable. And I thought, well, I don't have that art. It's something that you've been working on for a long time.
How to expose and to hide at the same time. Well, you know, I had thought you were going to write that essay, and so I agreed to do it. And then when you copped out, I felt sorry for the editor, a very nice guy named Andrew Blauner, and he had put together this book that has all these interesting writers in it, like Pete Hamill and Richard Ford.
Darren Strauss,
David Sedaris.
John Edgar Wideman,
exactly.
Jeffrey Wolfe, Tobias Wolfe, they're two writing brothers.
They write together. And there's a terrific essay by the brother of the Unabomber, David Kaczynski. See,
now and Michael Gilmore, the brother of
Gary Gilmore. Now, I didn't have any of that juicy material since, as far as I know.
I haven't killed anybody.
You haven't killed anybody, you know, so you really...
Well, at least not that I'm admitting to.
So you have your own secrets, is that it, Lenny?
Well, wait until I write my thing. So when you're doing something like that, whether it's this essay or something else,
yes,
where you know that there, as you say, there's a bit of a minefield, do you go through many drafts?
Yes, and I overwrite and then I cut back. So sometimes I say more and then, you know, but there is this strange detachment between when I'm writing, I, I, I I get this excitement if I approach the squeamish or the thing that one dare not say, and then I write it down, you know. And then the strange thing is that I'm actually rather a private person, and I don't actually tell people that much if they're in conversation with me. You would agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Oh, I think so. I'm much more likely to reveal everything. Spill the beans, and you make that point in the piece that you wrote.
Yeah, in person or in conversation, I'm rather restrained, and I think the younger brother has a choice, you know, to emulate and to individuate, you know. And I found myself doing both. I emulated you in many ways, but in order to develop a self that was not simply dominated by you, the older brother, I had to separate myself from you.
Many people who write fiction and nonfiction, and you've done both, talk about being able to use the fiction as a way of telling the real truths.
Yes.
And Sontag wrote a fair amount of fiction. Do you think that's where she revealed herself, or was she just as guarded there as she was in most of the essays?
I think she wasn't guarded in the essays. I think that they are profoundly revealing, but I don't think she was a very good fiction writer, and I'm not being radical by saying this. I think most critics would agree.
But that's where she felt she had achieved the most.
That's where she wanted to be known as a fiction writer. And she wasn't alone in this. There was a whole generation of writers like James Baldwin and Mary McCarthy and Gore Vidal, to some extent even Norman Mailer and Joan Didion, who are much better at nonfiction than fiction. But the big game was fiction. But the problem with her as a fiction writer, she didn't really have a ready sympathy for many people. Which made her wonderful as a critic. She had a strong sense of judgment, but she was not the most empathetic person in the world. And she didn't really have much of a sense of humor. So if you don't have empathy or a sense of humor, you're kind of a little bit tongue-tied when it comes to being a good novelist.
So how does that somebody who doesn't have a sense of humor, it seems to me, automatically has a major flaw, and I'm not sure I want to read somebody like
no,
that.
No, well, you know, I have a section in this book. This book is called Notes on Sontag, and I wrote about a lot of different aspects.
It's not
of
a biography, we should point out. It's
yes.
Although there are biographical details.
Yes, but it's really much more a kind of rumination and critical analysis of her. And she had a sense of irony. She appreciated the comic in literature. She had a weak sense of humor, I would say. It was not non-existent, but it wasn't that boisterous. And in some ways, part of the pleasure for me in writing this book was that I do care a lot about the comic, and I love it. I like to write humorously, and in a way, this was a chance to write about someone who wasn't able to laugh at herself, but I was able to laugh a little bit.
Her early novels were very experimental.
Yes.
About existential angst, I would say.
Exactly.
And then later, she turns to historical fiction.
Well, what happened was at the beginning, Sontag was very much a believer in the inevitable next step in art, the avant-garde. You had to kind of, you could never go back. So if you got the 12-tone music, you couldn't write tonal music. If you got the abstract painting, you couldn't do realistic painting. So she felt
you always had to push forward to the next stage. Well, sometimes as artists have discovered, it's hard to go to the next phase after abstraction.
Where do you go? You know, nullity. But I mean, my own feeling, and this was, I guess, one way I disagree with her, is that I tend to think of art as running in cycles, so that representation and abstraction, tonality, atonality, these things keep repeating. So if I could just read, she wrote this statement about the novels. She said, the surrender of the novel's commitment to facileness, to easy availability, and the perpetuation of an easy aesthetic will undoubtedly give rise to a great many boring and pretentious books, and one may well come to wish the old unself-conscious back again, but the price must be paid. In other words, we have to give up the realistic novel, even if we bore ourselves silly.
But didn't she start writing realistic novels later in her life?
Because she wrote these early books, The Benefactor and Death Kit, and they weren't successful, and even she acknowledged that they were rather dry. And so basically she came to to a change of heart and to say, well, you know, maybe realism, maybe narrative is not that bad. It may be facile, but maybe it's not that bad. And the same thing happened to her. At the beginning, she was against psychology. She was against realism. And she was against humanism. And of course, when she went to Sarajevo and, you know, went to the war zones and everything, she came back much more of a humanist.
So what happens to somebody like that who's made these very, very stringent statements? Really took very strong positions, right, and then later in life finds herself writing totally contradictory things. Did she ever acknowledge the fact that she had changed her mind?
She acknowledged it, but personally, I don't think there's any problem with somebody changing their mind or growing and changing, you know.
Except she became famous for many of those essays in which she took certain positions that she later disavowed.
Well, this is part of what was exciting about her, but was also dubious about her. She would take a position and she would kind of like take it to extremes. I think of her as an aphoristic writer, a writer who wrote in epigrams and maxims. And so sometimes the will to aphorize drove her to go further than she might have gone otherwise. But she didn't think against herself inside a piece. She would wait 10 years and then she would argue with an earlier form of herself. When I write essays, I tend to be much more self-doubting and to think, yes, but maybe there's another way of looking at this. But Sontag would back a position hard, and then she would reverse herself 5 or 10 years later.
Well, sometimes I imagine it is difficult for a writer. I think of Doris Lessing, mm-hmm. whose worldview changed an awful lot,
yes,
after she wrote her most famous book. And people still identify her with that book, and I'm sure she feels very ambivalent. On the one hand, she appreciates being made famous by The Golden Notebook, and at the same time would prefer that she hadn't written that book.
I'd like to just to say in relation to Doris Lessing that all of her work is filled with doubt, ambivalence, and skepticism, and self-skepticism, so that when she was in the Communist Party, when she saw herself as a kind of a card-carrying feminist, later on she changed from those positions. But the Golden Notebook is filled with self-doubt. So it isn't that she had to disown it. It's just that it didn't represent her final position.
My guest is Philip Lopate, who is the author of many books, including the essay collections Getting Personal, Against Joie de Vivre, Portrait of My Body, and Bachelorhood. Also, he edited the anthology, The Art of the Personal Essay, and he's written a full-length essay called Waterfront, A Walk Around Manhattan. There is film criticism, most recently a collection of novellas. So a little bit of everything over the years. And the latest two works are Notes on Sontag, which is published by Princeton University Press as part of their Writers on Writers series. And he's also one of the 26 contributors to a collection called Brothers, Stories of Love and Rivalry, with some of the more famous writers in America today, including Ethan Kanan, Benjamin Cheever, Dominic Dunn, Richard Ford.
I guess that's one reason I wanted to be in that collection, because of the good company. Yes.
This is really an impressive group of writers. Not me. And that book is published by Jossie Bass. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Philip Lopate, who just published Notes on Sontag from Princeton University Press. He's also in a collection that is edited by Andrew Blauner with a foreword by Frank McCourt called Brothers, 26 Stories of Love and Rivalry, published by Jossie Bass. And Frank McCourt knows a thing or two about being a brother.
That's
and
right.
Being part of a family where a number of brothers have made names for themselves. I just want to go back to Sontag for a moment longer,
sure,
because I think that there's another interesting aspect to her writing, and a reason that she became so important in American letters, and that is that she represented a French strain,
yes,
of criticism. American criticism was very different.
Yeah.
And closer to British criticism, wouldn't you say? I mean, the New York Review of Books, for example, is really quite different from anything that you might read in France.
Yes. I mean, Sontag was a kind of bridge figure who was bringing to America some of the dense philosophical qualities of prose that you find not just in French criticism but in German criticism. And
you mentioned she was aphoristic. Is that part
yes,
of that?
Yes, absolutely. She, you know, like a, it's a, this condensed zinger, that a way of style, you know, one zinger after another. And I think that the Anglo-American tradition is more unbuttoned, casual, conversational. You might almost call it more clubbable. And Sontag had a more a formal Mandarin quality to her prose. In a way, she wanted readers to struggle with it. The curious thing about Sontag is that she was both the most visible American intellectual of her day, and she also was a difficult writer at times, who would make readers feel stupid when they read her. Like, am I getting this? You know, because there was something slightly elusive and impersonal in her tone. You weren't quite sure always that you know what she was saying. And also, she had studied philosophy, so she drew on that philosophical tradition.
Well, she became dedicated to an ideal of excruciating seriousness
yes.
in literature and art, and yet she began her career advocating for a greater consideration of pop and low cultures,
yes,
as in her celebrated essay, Notes on Camp.
Notes on Camp, she wrote a wonderful essay about science fiction movies, and at the beginning she thought, okay, this high seriousness needs a little bit of levity, but what happened was that she, in advocating pop culture, she never could have imagined that eventually pop culture would trounce high culture. And I say in the book that it's like somebody who throws a stone at a schoolhouse and the whole schoolhouse crumbles, you know.
Now, and then she felt guilty?
She felt guilty. It wasn't that she made it crumble. I mean, pop culture was going to take over no matter what. But as she grew older, she became more and more attracted to difficult art. She fell in love with Wagner's operas. She loved Robert Wilson's six-hour drama performances, and the more difficult, the more she felt that it was her meat, you know. So she did not end up writing about, you know, Michael Jackson or Prince or anything like that, because she herself, as she grew older, she became less interested in popular culture.
You said that you didn't think she was particularly adept at fiction, but many people admire her short story, The Way We Live Now, about AIDS.
I think that's a good story, yes, and a very it brings us back to that moment when you had both new sense of community, people helping AIDS victims, HIV sufferers, and at the same time there's a real melancholy and loneliness in the story, because everybody dies alone finally.
Do you think she was better in the short form, a reason that there was more vitality in her essays?
Absolutely. I think she was, because she was somebody who could be so economical and aphoristic, she was much better at the short form, even in the short story and in the short essay. And when she wrote book-length essays, I think sometimes she ran the point into the ground.
We were talking before about making the private public. What are your feelings about the publication of her private journals and diaries by her son, David Reif? That material, I suspect, wasn't intended to be made public.
Well, I don't fault her son for doing that. I think that he argues persuasively that somebody was going to do it, and why not him?
Somebody who'd be most sympathetic to her and most understanding
yes.
of what she was trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, I myself found it rather tedious. And I don't think that the diaries do much to add to her glory as a writer. There's a lot of lists, and then there were sort of complaints that people aren't treating her well enough. So she shows at times a self-awareness and at times a complete lack of self-awareness. So I don't know. This is just the first volume of the diary, and it may change in character. It may become something much more wonderful.
And do you think because the essay form always seems so ephemeral, mm-hmm. and especially in her case, since she's responding to things of the moment, that this is a career that will have real longevity?
Yes, I think that she belongs in the canon of American nonfiction literature, that she'll be seen as one of our most important essayists. And I think that even if her positions may seem dated at times, her prose will still be inspiring.
It brings to mind something else that just happened recently, Hemingway's grandson re-editing The Movable Feast, and the argument over whether his version was any better than Mary Hemingway's? The last Mrs. Hemingway's version.
Well, let a thousand flowers bloom. I'd like it that both would be in the marketplace, and we could make our own decisions.
My guest is Philip Lopate, and we're talking about essays and writing in general. The two books that he has been involved with most recently, Notes on Sontag, which is published as part of the Writers on Writers series by Princeton University Press. He's also one of the contributors to Brothers, 26 Stories of Love and Rivalry, which is edited by Andrew Blauner and contains some really fascinating range of meditations on Brothers. It is published by Jossie Bass. And during the break, you said you wanted to talk more about Brothers. I'm not sure I do.
Well, there is something very bizarre and meta about talking to my brother about an essay I wrote about him, where he's interviewing me and pretending that he has no reaction to it. So what did you feel when you read the essay?
I thought that in general it was affectionate, and there were a few things that I probably would have edited out if I were, if I were editing your collected works after your death.
I see. So if you're in the position of Mary Hemingway, those passages. But were you surprised by the amount of affection?
No, not at all, because I think that we have affection for each other, and that's something that's quite apparent in our regular interactions.
I think
anybody seeing us would feel that way.
Yes, it's funny. I think that we have affection for each other, but sometimes when we're not in the same room, other people talk to us about the other. They say things like, gee, I'd like to go on your brother's show. Are you talking to him? Do you have a problem with that? I say, no, I don't have a problem with that, but I'm not the producer, and I don't want to touch that one.
And people approach me about contacting you as well. But you point out in the essay, and this is something that I think probably not only applies to us, but to an awful lot of brothers, people immediately assume that there is a rivalry, and sometimes they even try to play one of us against the other.
Yeah, there's no question that people have a little bit of a...
Why do you think that is?
A sadistic... I think they did it to us even when we were very young, you know?
I remember a guy who ran a gallery, and I was trying to get a gallery show.
Yeah.
And he said, he was looking at my work, and you were there, and he said, you know, Philip, you're much better looking than Leonard. And I, at the time, I was stunned because it had nothing to do with the work, but I wanted him to give me a show. And I thought, why would anybody say something so tactless, even if it were true?
Yes, but now you took revenge because you're more better looking than I am.
Well, that's for others to decide.
Well, fortunately, this is radio, so we don't have to get listeners to vote in or anything like that.
But that kind of thing happens a lot with us and other brothers.
They do two things. They play us off against each other, and they also confusingly think that we're the same person. So they'll come to a reading of mine and they'll say, oh, I love your radio show. And, you know, I think, isn't that bizarre that they would think I write all these books and I still have a daily radio show?
And people have said to me that they're just amazed that I could do this show and write all those books.
They just don't want to believe that there are two Lopates who are accomplished, you know.
But I don't understand. That's like confusing me with other people who do talk shows. I guess it's either people don't think much about the details of, a writer's life or a talk show host's life, or maybe they want to think that there are these superhuman people who can do it all.
But I do think that there are people, obviously, who are more attached to you than to me, and understandably, you know, they invite you into their homes every day, that you're part of their life, their daily life. And so when they meet me, they almost unconsciously want to take your side against me as though we were in some kind of contentious situation. But the reality is there is competitiveness between us.
But people automatically assume sibling rivalry.
Yeah. But I think that sibling rivalry is a reality. But the question is how big in a reality is it, or how defining is it? You know, you can live with sibling rivalry because there's also sibling love.
Well, you may feel sibling rivalry, but Philip, I don't.
Oh, okay. Glad to hear it.
I think that I'm very proud of what you've done over the years,
and that's it. Yeah, yeah. No, I don't know if it's rivalry, but it's. I used the word emulation before. I feel like I want to do the best I can, partly because I see you doing the best you can. It's just you set a standard for me.
Oh, that's so kind of you. Meanwhile, what are you working on? You wrote this essay.
Yes, it's a funny thing, but in a period of 18 months, I will have published these two novellas, which is called Two Marriages, published the book on Sontag, which is nonfiction. And then in January, I'm coming out with selected poems.
Now, these are poems from earlier in your career?
Or yes.
Have you been writing poetry all along?
I haven't. I stopped writing about 1985. And recently, a small press, Marsh Hawk Press, which is a very good poetry press, approached me and said, why don't we bring out your books of poetry? So I said, that's great. I'd forgotten about them almost, you know.
Well, I asked you earlier about Susan Sontag, yes, going back and looking at old essays and wondering whether she wanted to be connected to some of them, because her ideas had changed so much. What happens when you look at old essays or look at old poems?
I looked at these old poems, and I had two responses. One was, well, these are pretty interesting. And the other was, these are embarrassing. They're such a young man's poetry, you know.
Well, did you recognize yourself in them?
I recognized that self. I thought, oh, yes, I remember when I was that way, you know. And I seemed a little callow. I seemed a little hungry. I seemed horny, if you will. But I also thought there was something human and vulnerable about them, and that they were honest for that period, you know. And I can't really, I wasn't inclined to rewrite them. I let them stand. I think people can get some pleasure out of them, even though they're not the height of wisdom.
Well, I remember asking a writer about some publishing old short stories in a collected best of whatever, and he said that these works are all snapshots,
yes,
of a given moment, and if you understand that you look different than you did when you were 20, 25, exactly, 30, 35, whatever, that each one of those things is what they are in themselves, and you have two choices. You can either try to make them all what you are now,
yes,
or you can just simply accept the fact that you look differently then.
Exactly. Like Yeats actually rewrote some of his poems from his youth, but Whitman just kept adding. And I like the Whitman idea of the additive and the aggregate, that in the end, leaves of grass kept getting fatter and fatter, and he said, well, this is who I am over a long period.
Mm-hmm. And are you tempted at all to, now that you're publishing these poems, to go back and write any poetry?
Yes, I'd like to go back. In fact, I rewrote some of the uncollected poems because they needed to be set again. And I found myself saying, I can make this line a little better, you know. And then I thought, what fun it is to write poetry, because you're just working with little word choices, you know, and it really, the hours fly by. What can I say?
You've established yourself as one of the defenders of the personal essay, mm-hmm, and poetry is often a personal essay.
Yes, lyrical and personal. A lot of times it is, yeah. By the way, I also love the impersonal essay, and I think that Notes on Sontag is largely an impersonal essay.
Mm-hmm. And Waterfront was as well.
So I swing both ways, you might say.
Okay. Since I love you and you're my brother, I'm not even going to pursue that. But I do want to thank you for being our guest again. Philip has two new things published. There's Notes on Sontag, which is published by Princeton University Press. I should say three things, because Two Marriages, which came out pretty recently from other press, is still in the bookstores. And now there's Brothers. He is one of 26 contributors to this book that's edited by Andrew Blauner, with a foreword by Frank McCourt, published by Jossie Bass. And Philip, it's always a pleasure. Oh, and now, and when is the poetry coming out?
In January.
It's always a pleasure having you on the show.
I love to be on it.
On tomorrow's show, Chef Michael LaMonaco returns for the final part of our Food in the City series. And then we'll get a comprehensive history of America's infatuation with Chinese food. Also, it's been 400 years since Henry Hudson sailed up the river that's been named after him. Hear the story of his final doomed expedition in the winter of 1610. Plus, Christopher Reeve's daughter and the chair of the Department of Rehabilitation at the Boston School of Medicine discuss spinal cord injuries and the latest advances in treating patients who are paralyzed. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angela Sheldon, Natalie Pano, Nicole Silbersack, and Alex Conrad. Jason Isaac was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.